Hello and welcome into another edition of Informed Utah, part of the JMAC podcast, where we focus in on Utah issues. Today I had the opportunity to sit down with Utah State Senator Kurt Bramble. We talked about a couple of important issues that I think will be important to you. They're important to me. The first one is licensing requirements in the state of Utah. You might wonder why that's important to me. I have an issue with industries using legislation to protect their market share. I don't think it's good for capitalism. And I think we see examples of this all over the country. Fortunately, Utah has been better about this. And the governor and the state legislature are taking some time to look at these issues and look at areas where we may need licensing, we may not. And when are industries just protecting their turf? And when do they have legitimate claims and concerns? He'll share his thoughts on that. Then we also talked about the redistricting process and that word gerrymandering. And how is the census going to affect his district? It's very interesting. And finally, we talked with him about requests he's getting to have a forensic audit of the 2020 election in the state of Utah. Who is he getting this request from, and what does he feel is the proper course of action when it comes to verifying that Utah had a fair and accurate election? Senator, thank you so much for joining us today. I saw that you are working with the governor and other members of the legislature to focus in on the licensing requirements in the state. And this is important to me because I'm a fan of good regulation. I'm not a fan of regulation that is there just for the sake of being there and doesn't really protect people and keeps good people out of industry. And so tell me why this came up, first of all, and what type of requirements are you looking at changing?
Okay, well, first of all, you have to decide what is the prime objective of licensing. Is it to protect public health, safety, or is it to protect an industry? Now, in my career, I'm a licensed CPA, but being a licensed CPA doesn't protect my turf at all because I'm a tax practitioner. You could hang on a shingle. I don't know what your background in taxes are. Let's assume you have zero. I mean, I love listening to you when the JMAC show was on.
Well, thank you.
You could have zero experience with income taxes. You may not know how to spell IRS. You may not know what the Internal Revenue Code is. You may not know what Title 59 of the state code is, but you could hang on a shingle 10 minutes from now and you could compete head to head. I'm a CPA. I've been licensed for almost 40 years in Utah. I've been part of the group that has authored about 80% of our tax code that currently exists. In other words, I'm a recognized professional. Mm-hmm. I have zero protection from licensing. The only thing that a licensed CPA is really licensed to do is sign financial statements, audited financial statements. I don't do that. I do taxes. No barrier to entry in taxes.
So anybody can compete with you, and basically the consumer doesn't have any protection that or any verification of my experience, background, licensing, or anything like that.
That's right. Now, you can go to the fast food of tax preparation, the go into the malls or the storefront, and I won't name any names. Mm-hmm. But you can go in, and those folks have a week or two night training, and they become tax experts.
Right.
Those of us with master's degrees and years of administrative experience with the IRS, state tax commissions, and whatever, we compete head to head. They charge their fee structure is different, but it doesn't matter because you get what you pay for, and the market works that out. And there is no need to license tax professionals. Okay. So let's get into what's happening here in Utah. Let me give you three examples that are kind of set the stage for what we're looking at.
Okay.
The first one, actually, I'll give you four. The first one was a few years ago. We had veterinarians and massage therapists going head to head because veterinarians wanted to be able to massage livestock. Mm-hmm. Apparently, cows give better milk. The hamburger tastes better if it's a happy cow before it gets butchered.
I had no
okay?
idea.
I didn't either. And so on the floor of the Senate, we had a grand debate. The massage therapists were arguing that vets could not massage cows or horses unless they were licensed massage therapists. And vets were saying massage therapists can't touch animals because animals are animals and vets are the only ones licensed to provide any medical services to animals. And I'm thinking during this debate, I like mine medium rare. And so that it was interesting. That was a battle about turf, a battle about scope of practice, but it was really about the financial implications of who could massage cows. Going along that same line with massage therapists, 3 years ago, I think maybe 4 years ago, barbers, when they give a traditional men's haircut, you go to the barber, a cut and a shave. When they're all done, they may take their hands and just do a little light scalp neck massage.
Mm-hmm.
The massage therapists came to the DOPL and they came to the legislature saying that that is a not within the scope of practice of barbers. It's a violation of the Massage Therapy Act, and barbers should be prohibited from massaging someone's scalp or neck, even if it's a light massage, because anyone performing a massage that was not trained, it would cause irreparable neurologic damage.
Oh, wow.
Now, Jay, I take my role as a state senator very seriously. It's a solemn occasion to be chairing the Business Labor Committee, which I chair. And in the spirit of solemnity and seriousness, as the massage therapists were testifying about how dangerous it is for someone to massage your neck or scalp unless they were licensed and qualified massage therapist, I had my wife standing behind me massaging my neck as I was chairing the meeting.
That's fantastic. And did she cause irreparable damage?
Only to my pocketbook over the last 44 years. The point is, you look at those kinds of things. This year, we received over 50,000 emails in opposition to a bill. There's a burgeoning industry called blow-dry bars.
Right.
Where men and women want to go get their hair shampooed, blow-dried, and styled. Well, the cosmetologist said that you have to spend $20,000 or $30,000, 1,600 hours to be able to shampoo, blow dry, and style someone's hair, because blow dryers, and they put this on record, blow dryers are dangerous tools that in the hands of someone untrained could cause irreparable harm. A curling iron heats up to over 1,000 degrees and could cause serious harm. And if you go to your local department store, Walmart or whatever, and buy the wrong shampoo, it could destroy your hair.
Mm.
We wanted to have an exemption for shampooing, blow drying, and styling.
Yeah.
Okay. This was a testimony that the industry gave on record. Well, my response, my wife, we have 16 grandkids. They love to have grandma style their hair.
Mm-hmm.
And when I pointed that out, the response was, yes, but she's not being paid. And I said, well, hold it. Either these tools are dangerous and you need to be trained and licensed to use a blow dryer and a curling iron or not. The question of safety and the use of those tools has nothing to do with whether you're compensated or not. High school kids, girls doing each other's hair for prom.
Okay.
Well, we passed that bill. The governor, to Governor Cox's credit, the very first executive order that he issued was a review of Utah's licensing and regulatory environment. We have a new director of the Department of Commerce, Margaret Bussey. She and Mark Steinigel, the head of DOPL, and the governor, myself, my counterpart in the House, Representative Joel Ferry, who's the House Chair of Business Labor, we've been working on for 6 months developing the criteria. What is the primary reason for licensing? And then how do the licenses in the state fit?
Yeah.
There's another aspect that comes up. Take a social worker. We license social workers in Utah because of the training, education, and the clientele that social workers generally deal with are at-risk populations, whether it's in public schools or the mental health community or whatever. Turns out the State Board of Education says that a DOPL licensed social worker doesn't qualify to work in the public schools. Only a State Board of Education certified social worker trained by a particular university should be qualified to work in schools. So you could have a social worker qualified to work with an individual outside of the public education, completely competent and qualified, but in school, the state board says, no, you have DOPL that issues a license, but we're going to require a second license, a second or third certification. We're not going to a state agency is not going to recognize the state licensing of a social worker. Now, that's ludicrous.
It is. And why?
Well,
what is the reasoning?
I was just on a conference call today on that very topic. So we have a bill that will be introduced on September 15th. That's our next interim committee meeting. The bill is going to be introduced, and the kind of the high level bullet points of what the bill, this draft bill, that's our stake in the ground. That will be the starting point for actually having a bill come out of the interim committee process by the end of November. And that we're not going to be taking public comment in September. We're going to have Mark Steinigle, the head of DOPL, introduce the concepts that are in the bill. And the reason we're putting it on the committee agenda is so that it will be in the public record, so that the public will have from September 15th, they'll have 30 days till the October interim meeting to formulate their comments and their response. And in October, we'll consider any amendments, revisions, refinements. We'll go back to the public with those amendments and refinements. Then in November, we expect it to come up for final passage. And what are the elements going to be? We're going to be taking a careful look. Are the in a particular profession, a particular industry, are these primarily turf, or are the is there material elements of public health and safety? Are the scope of the licenses, take the cosmetology. We've had major battles now over the last decade, braiding. Cosmetologists opposed having braiding bars. And that goes to some racist issues because certain ethnic hairstyles, braiding is far more prevalent than in other ethnic communities. And yet someone from a particular background couldn't offer themselves to other folks in their demographic arena to do braiding unless they paid $20,000 or $30,000 and 1600 hours at a beauty to get licensed.
Yeah.
Same with blow drying. And those are just, those are kind of marquee examples, but the roots of this go much deeper across many of the professions. So we want to look at the scope of what licensing allows and more appropriately what it prohibits within various professions. Is that right sized, or should we look at refining it? And that's why I started with the CPA profession. Most people, when they come to me as a CPA, if you came to me as a CPA to do taxes, you would think, well, Bramble's a CPA. He's met the criteria from the American Institute of CPAs. Mm-hmm. He is licensed in the state. He should be qualified to do my taxes. How about if you go to Jackson Hewitt, H&R Block, or any of the other companies where they don't have master's degrees and whatever, in other words, we don't need it, we don't want it, but it gives you an example of where it works really well within a profession to have certain aspects of the profession require licensing.
Right.
In the CPA profession, you want someone to have their license on the line if they're going to be signing financial statements, and third-party investors and banks and bonding companies and the general public is going to be relying on that attest function that says that these financials present fairly the results of operations and the financial position of a company. You want there to be the teeth that if an individual is either incompetent or fraudulent in the preparation of that financial statement, you want to be able to prohibit them from doing that because a number of other people are relying on it. In the case of tax practitioners, if I do your taxes, there's one person that relies on the accuracy of those taxes, and that's you. And if you're audited and you find that I screwed up, I could be subject to malpractice or whatever. Mm-hmm. But other people generally, I'm not signing a tax return for the general public's consumption. Look at Donald Trump fighting tooth and nail to keep his taxes private, even in the light of Congress and yep. New York Attorney General and whatever trying to get to him. Other people don't rely on your tax return, right?
Yeah.
But if I did your financial statements and I sign it as a certified public accountant, the world would rely on the validity of those documents. And that gives you an example where within a profession, some aspects require licensing, some don't. You can look at that with beauticians, barbers, massage therapists. You can just go down the list of licensed professions, either vocations or professions, and see that mission creep. It's really an appropriate time to look at reining them in,
yeah.
resizing them, and making them fit. As technology changes, business models change, definitions become arcane. And by the way, that is true across the scope of our state code. It doesn't matter. It's true in, you wouldn't be having this podcast 20 years ago because the technology didn't exist for it.
That's right.
Online sales tax, just a whole spectrum of things change. And yet our licensing tends to be rather static.
Yeah.
So that's really what's going on.
Well, I love that you're going after it because one of the things that drives me crazy is when people use, when they use laws, as you say, you call it turf. I'd say to protect their market share or whatever it is. And they make up excuses like neurological damage for a massage or something. You can tell they're grasping at straws. And what they're doing is they're just trying to protect their business and their market share. And to me, in an environment where we believe in capitalism, supply and demand, where the consumer makes the choice, and that is what drives efficiency and quality and helps us move forward through technology. The more laws that are allowed to be passed in that regard, the less opportunity there is for capitalism to work. And
let me give you another example. When you own an automobile, I presume. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what from your talk show, what kind of car, but you'd mentioned it a time or two.
Yeah, it depends. I have a newer car, but I have a 1972 Ford Bronco too. So
okay.
Yeah.
So when you take that Ford Bronco into a automotive repair shop, is that shop licensed?
They have, I remember they have like a big thing on the wall, ASE or something like that.
There is no state licensing of automobile mechanics.
Really? I had no idea.
Now, automobile mechanics can be certified by the ACME, or whatever that big, that is a certification. Many, many dealerships require their mechanics to meet the certifications of the particular manufacturer, whatever dealer, a Chevy dealer, a Ford, Dodge, whatever. They require their mechanics to be certified by the manufacturer. A general automotive shop that would be more akin for your Bronco, there is no licensing. And yet, when you get in that Bronco, if they didn't put the U-joints in properly and a U-joint falls out and it drops the drive shaft and the drive shaft causes your vehicle to pole vault into an upside down position at 50 miles an hour, bad things could happen.
That's right.
So why don't we require automobile repairmen to be licensed? Because the market has figured out that mechanics certification, and the public is smart enough to go to a qualified mechanic.
Yeah, and there are real world ramifications for poor service, and there are liabilities for.
I'll give you an example that we did this year. Utah's the first in the nation. Physician's assistants up until Senate Bill 27 and 28 that passed this year and governor signed them as part of this relooking at licensing, physician's assistants were required to have a supervising physician. COVID comes along in March of 2020. A rural town in Utah, Gunnison, has one physician in town. Mm. He and his physician's assistant had been practicing together for over 13 years. The physician dies.
Mm.
The town has no healthcare professional unless the PA is allowed to practice. And yet the law said without a supervising physician, the physician assistant can't do it. Mm-hmm. So what did we do this year? We said that the PAs within their scope of practice, the expertise of their experience and their education can practice autonomously, but they're limited to their experience and their expertise. Now, if you think about this for a moment, you go to medical school, you come out with a medical degree, you are legally able to perform brain surgery the minute you become licensed as a doctor. What limits you from being a brain surgeon or a heart surgeon out of medical school? It's not your state license, it's board certifications, it's insurance providers, you know, the health insurance companies, it's the privileges at hospitals. It's Medicaid, Medicare. There's a number of guardrails that would stop you from practicing beyond your scope. Those same things apply to PAs. And so it was interesting, the medical community, ultimately they came on board and supported the bill. But early on they said, well, what stops a PA from going out and performing heart surgery when they come out of PA school? And unless they're supervisors. So what stops a doctor from doing it?
All those things, yeah.
Okay. Well, now in Utah, we're the first state to give PAs that kind of autonomy. They have to meet certain experience criteria, similar to a residency. They can't just start practice right out of school, very similar to doctors that have to go through residency and training and whatever. But PAs will be able to practice autonomously in Utah going forward. Interesting, during COVID, that was the only way that many communities in our state had quality health care.
Right.
And there were some sectors that said, well, don't let the data from COVID set a precedent. Don't let the fact that it worked while we're under COVID, just don't let that be a precedent, right?
Yeah.
The other thing we did, we'll, again, first in the nation, allow PAs to practice autonomously in the mental health arena. And our mental health practitioners, we have a huge deficiency. There's a huge shortage of qualified mental health practitioners in the state of Utah. COVID has exacerbated that with the mental health from quarantines and masks and all of those kinds of things. So these are examples, Jay, that we have been making some progress, sometimes significant, like with the PAs, sometimes nominal, like with the blow drying.
Yeah.
But they give rise to why was this his very first executive order? Why is the very agency that oversees licensing enthusiastically coming on board and saying, no, we want to limit and right size where our jurisdiction is? About the only ones right now that are pushing back hard are the trade associations and the advocates for those trade associations.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I think the other question to ask is, why is the economy in the state of Utah doing so much better than other states? It's this type of thinking, I believe. Regulation when necessary to protect the public, but not for turf protection or other things. Let the consumer be the guide. And I love it. So I love that you're doing that. And I'll keep in touch with you about that.
Well, final point on this.
Yeah.
This is a team effort. I applaud the governor. Margaret Bussey is the new director of the Department of Commerce, Mark Steinigle, my House co-chair, Joel Ferry, and a host of other players. This is going to be a team effort, a coalition of the willing to bring this forward.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Another issue on the radar, and I know this impacted you. We got the census numbers in, and the redistricting commission has fired up. And there's going to be some changes to some of these districts, and you're going to experience that possibly.
I am. Ironically, when the numbers came in, I represent Senate District 16, which is essentially Provo and a part of Orem. We came in, my Senate district grew by about 517 citizens. That puts it 16,000 and some change under what it should be given the new census numbers for the state of Utah. In other words, we have 3.2 million people. We have 29 Senate districts. Each Senate district needs to have roughly 112 or 113,000 citizens. Mine has 95,000.
You don't have enough.
I don't have enough. And the reason for it analytically, it's actually kind of humorous. I represent Provo, which is a college town. There's about 32,000, 33,000 BYU students, roughly 20 or 25,000 live in student housing. Mm-hmm. During COVID, much of the student housing in Provo, in Logan, in Idaho Falls, in Boston at Harvard, most of the student housing across the country was shut down. And in Provo, it made a material difference. The interesting thing about redistricting, though, it doesn't matter where you start. If you start on the rural edges of the state and you start setting up communities of interest and rationally designed Senate districts that include complete counties and cities and whatever, the more you get into the populated area, you're going to start slicing and dicing communities to come up with equal population. If you start in Salt Lake City as ground zero and make Salt Lake City cohesive legislative districts or congressional districts, when you start moving out, you're going to start slicing and dicing other communities. And what I've learned in my 21 years in the Senate, gerrymandering is in the eye of the beholder. In Utah, yes. the argument about should we have four congressional districts that represent both urban and rural so that we get a balance in Congress versus should we create a Senate district specifically that would have a Democrat majority. Now, I would argue that either one of those, if you're Republican, you argue that it's gerrymandering to give a majority Democrat district.
Democrat, right.
If you're a Democrat, you argue that urban-rural mix is gerrymandering.
It's gerrymandering.
And no matter how you cut it, the individual whose ideology or expectations of parochial, tribal, partisanship, whatever, if they're not met, it is solely because of gerrymandering. And yet the reality is the wisdom of our Constitution leaves that decision. It's a political decision, mm-hmm. and it leaves it in the hands constitutionally of the elected officials in the legislature.
Yeah, and I've been saying to people recently, tell me how you get, for congressional districts, tell me how you get four equal numbered congressional districts without slicing up Salt Lake. I mean, draw that map for me. It's not easy to do in the state of Utah because of where the population centers are. It's just, you know, and I love that I've spoken to the co-chair of the redistricting committee, and I love how they're going to be accepting maps from the public. They've got a great piece of software where you can go online and draw your own maps, but you got to draw them all. You can't just draw the one that you want.
And the dominoes, when you do that, the dominoes will fall. Now, in my case, I've already communicated to the chairs, to our caucus, and to leadership. Because Senate District 16 has to grow by 16,000 citizens, that means a district has to expand. I don't care if it expands into Wasatch. I'm already in Wasatch County. I don't care if it expands into Charleston and Midway. Mm-hmm. I don't care if it expands into Orem or West Provo. In other words, if you look at where my district is, it could expand north, south, east, or west. It doesn't matter. Just make it a district with the requisite population.
Yeah.
And now, by the way,
I also learned that apparently it's gerrymandering. It's like the difference between GIF or GIF. I'm not. Apparently, the guy who did it, his name was Gary, not Jerry. So there you go.
Well, that's how it's spelled, but that's not how it's been pronounced.
I know. I'm sticking with gerrymandering because that's, you know, I'm old school like that. Hey, one more thought before we go. You had mentioned to me you're getting a lot of pressure to audit the state voting rolls because of the allegations about voter fraud. Tell me about that. Where is that pressure is coming from and what is your response to that pressure?
Well, I don't know who the drivers behind it are. I know nationally folks that were sympathetic to President Trump are kind of the drivers on a national scene. I don't know who in the state of Utah is really the driving force. But as a CPA, when someone says we want a forensic audit, the term forensic audit has very specific implications. You commence a forensic audit when you have facts and evidence that leads you to believe that that something is amiss.
Right.
Facts, not speculation.
Not conjecture, yeah.
Not conjecture.
Yes.
You want a string that you can grab that string and begin pulling it. And I've told, my response has been virtually, and I've gotten hundreds of emails demanding a forensic audit. First of all, kind of facetiously, I said, well, so you don't accept the outcome of Utah's election that we, as Republicans, all four congressional seats were properly counted and Republicans won.
And that the state went to Trump.
And the state went to Trump.
Yeah.
And we have no Republican, statewide Republican office holders today.
Yeah.
And we elected some Republican state school board members, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Oh, no. We think the outcome was right. We just think the numbers were wrong. And so we want a forensic audit.
Yeah.
Jay, the problem is the cost and spending the people's treasury on that kind of an activity. I'm not in favor of it until I've been presented with credible, something tangible that would lead me to believe that there was fraud. Jay, back in 2005, I introduced Senate Bill 227 with Becky Lockhart. It gave rise to the driving privilege card in Utah. There was evidence that had been presented, a name and individual that was undocumented, and we, at the time, Utah had regular driver's licenses for undocumented individuals. Mm-hmm. The allegation was that undocumented individuals were using Utah driver's licenses to register to vote and to vote.
Right.
Now, that has been an allegation before 2005. That's certainly an allegation now, particularly with what's going on at the borders mm-hmm. of Mexico and such. But before Becky and I, and Becky, rest her soul, became Speaker of the House, very close friend, before she and I would team up on Senate Bill 227 to introduce the driving privilege card, we wanted to have a legislative audit. Before we could get support for a legislative audit, we had to produce at least one likely situation,
right,
evidence,
yeah,
where an undocumented individual appeared to have registered to vote and voted. We were able to do that. The legislative auditor general went in, did a complete audit of our elections, and we found, yes, in fact, in Utah, because of the regular driver's licenses, undocumented individuals were registering to vote, and in less than a dozen cases, after looking at tens of thousands of voting records, they found less than a dozen situations where an illegal alien had actually voted.
Mm-hmm.
But it started with actual evidence,
right,
of an individual.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I've asked the folks that are demanding a forensic audit today to produce the same kind of factual evidence that would be justification for a forensic audit. And thus far, it hasn't existed in Utah. It hasn't existed through all the court cases in every state where the elections have been challenged.
Well, and I think it's so important to ask the question, and then what? If you just say, okay, we'll do a forensic audit because somebody doesn't like the outcome and they don't have any evidence, you've now set the standard, and that means every election, and it will be every election for the rest of time, you will now have to do a forensic audit. And so what you're doing, in my opinion, is you're decreasing faith in the electoral process when you take these actions without evidence.
Well, and the reality is, in every election, there will be some element of fraud.
Absolutely.
Some of it benign.
Mm-hmm.
A husband and wife get their ballots, and the wife says, sweetheart, you mark my ballot for me. I don't know who I'm going to vote for. Technically, that's ballot fraud, but it's benign ballot fraud. Mm-hmm. Okay? The idea that the dead... I'm from Chicago originally. Voting early, voting often.
Yes.
Voting from, yeah, your permanent residence after, mm-hmm, you die. I mean, all that has been part and parcel of the Chicago,
yes,
experience, but not the Utah experience.
Right. And even I've looked into those Chicago experiences, and you may know more than me, but they all happen within a particular county where you had single control. In order for this type of widespread voter fraud, just in the state of Utah, can you still hear me? Did your battery die on your headphones?
My battery died on my headphones, so yeah, that's I can fine. Still hear you.
Yeah, you still sound great.
Well, but Jay, imagine, look, you ran for office.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine what it would be like to have the kind of supporters that Richard J. Daley had when he was mayor of Chicago. Those folks, when they were living, they had patronage jobs working for the city of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And they were so committed that after they died, they continued working for the city of Chicago and they donated their entire paychecks to the mayor's campaign.
Yep.
I haven't seen anyone be able to do that in Utah.
Yeah. And again, the individual districts, each district chair would have to be in on it. My concern is, as I talk to people who make these allegations, the first thing that becomes very obvious to me is they have no clue how our election is handled. They don't know who prints the ballots. They don't know anything about the machines. They don't know how the signatures are checked. They don't know anything. They're just believing what they hear, and they think these machines are all plugged into the internet and that China can just hack into them. And they're not. It just doesn't work that way.
Well, and Jay, anecdotally, my wife's parents, both of them passed away during 2000.
Hmm.
My mother-in-law passed away from cancer on March 11th. We had a primary in June. We didn't get a ballot mailed in her name to their address. My father-in-law passed away in August. We didn't get a ballot for him for the November election. In other words, the allegations that people, when they pass away, there's still ballots going out or whatever. We had two circumstances in my own immediate family where the names had been purged from the voter registration rolls because of their passing. And so the allegations that, well, when people die, they're still in the rolls and the ballots are being mailed out.
Mm-hmm.
We're not seeing it.
No. And every once in a while, possibly individual cases. Senator, anything else on your radar right now that you wanted to bring up?
Sure. Are you announcing that you're going to be running for office after redistricting?
I am. I am not making any announcements today.
Uh-huh. See, I'm turning the table on a journalist here.
Yeah. Well, it's fair game because I did run, so it's definitely fair game. We have all the signs in the garage still, and we did the spring clean, and we're like, what should we do with these? They're still in the garage. So
did you put the district number on them?
No.
Well, see, I did, and, uh-huh. and I've now been through two redistrictings. I was elected in 2000 in Senate District 16, mm-hmm. went through the redistricting in 2001. They kept my Senate district number the same. We went through redistricting in 2011. They kept my district number the same, and I'm hoping that in 2021 they keep my district number the same, because all of my signs have District 16 on them.
Oh, just get out the Sharpie, you know, it'll be fine.
Yeah, really.
Do it old school.
Well, Jay, thanks for the opportunity.
Once again, I want to thank the state senator for joining us today and thank him for all of his hard work. I think the issue of licensing and regulation is an important one. As he said, industries are always changing. And so I think as a state legislature, they need to always be looking at this and always updating and making it so regulation is there to protect the public when the public needs protecting. But when it's just there to protect an industry's turf, come on, we got to stop doing that. And so I'm glad to see them working on this. We'll also watch the redistricting process and see how that works. And he's right, no matter how the districts are aligned, there will be the claim gerrymandering. I just think the last thing that needs to be considered when putting together any district is the how it will affect the parties. That should not come into play, if you ask me. But you know, we'll talk about that another day. And we do have an invitation to go and watch and participate in the redistricting process as they redraw those maps. We're going to take advantage of that. And finally, the election fraud claims. I agree with the senator that until you have evidence, more than a feeling, then we can't just go around doing forensic audits just because somebody's not happy with the outcome or they can't believe that one candidate beat another candidate. So once again, I want to thank the senator for joining us. I want to ask you to become a supporter of this podcast. If you go to my website, jmcfarland.com, if you become a patron, there's lots of great rewards and benefits. As little as $5 a month can help me continue to pay for these services that bring you this broadcast. and help me do more of it, which I absolutely want to do. And I hope you want more. You want more, J-Mac, right? Come on, I know you do. With that, thank you and have a wonderful day.